Okay, good evening. Welcome, everyone, to the 529 Emergency Preparedness Discussion Net, courtesy of the WA7ABU 529 repeater. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. My name's Brett, and I'm net control for today, August 25th, 2020. This net meets each Tuesday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. local time on 145.29 megahertz. This is a designated emergency frequency, so we'll break if any real emergency occurs. Our alternate frequency is 145.19 with a tone of 100. We appreciate those who stand by and allow us to have a clear frequency for the next hour as we discuss emergency preparedness with particular emphasis on the COVID-19 pandemic and the medical aspects of the pandemic. We have special guest tonight, Sheila Sund, MD, who will answer your medical questions about COVID-19. All amateur operators are welcome to participate in the COVID-19 discussions during this net. We try to stay away from the political side of it as far as it goes, but any questions related to understanding what's happening as far as rulemaking, policies, those kinds of things might be explainable in a neutral fashion. If you want to have time to address everybody's questions, after you check in, when you do check in, I'd like you to let me know if you have a question. I'll go ahead and mark you down, and then we'll take like one question per person until we make sure everybody has a chance. Anyway, after the check-in period, we'll have an introduction for the day's events by the doctor. When you check in, please identify with your call sign slowly and phonetically, and also your name and location to be recognized by net control. Let's see if there's anybody on Echolink that would like to check in for the emergency preparedness net. Come now, please. Okay, hearing no one, let's take general check-ins for the 529 check net, emergency preparedness net. Sorry.
W7 November Alpha Tango, Nate.
Okay, 6 Sierra Tango, X-ray Dan and Kaiser.
Kilo India 7, Echo Sierra Whiskey, Curtis and Kaiser.
Kilo India 7 Foxtrot Whiskey Hotel and Kilo India 7 Foxtrot Whiskey Papa, Alan and Jennifer, South Salem.
Whiskey Alpha 7 Hotel Sierra Bravo, Jerry and Silverton.
Kilo 7 November Uniform India, Bill and Canby.
Okay, let's take a pause there with Bill. That was Kilo 7 November Uniform India. Welcome. Before that was Jerry, Whiskey Alpha 7 Hotel Sierra Bravo. And I just have to mention that Jerry, there is a signal coming from Newburgh, zooming right over your head, connected to the Victor Point station there. So we are now connected to Yamhill County by RF. That's for tomorrow's net, though. Before that, we had Alan and Jennifer, Kilo India 7 Foxtrot Whiskey Hotel and Kilo India 7 Foxtrot Whiskey Papa. Before that was our buddy Curtis, Kilo India 7 Echo Sierra Whiskey, Kaiser there. Kilo 6 Sierra Tango X-ray, also from Kaiser. He's just checked in before that. And Nate started the group off, Whiskey 7 November Alpha Tango. Thank you all for checking in. Anybody else?
November Whiskey 7 Oscar Romeo and November 7 Delta Kilo Bravo, Richard and Deborah in Albany.
Okay, so let's pause there for just a minute. We got two strong signals, November Whiskey 7 Oscar Romeo and November 7 Delta Kilo Bravo. Now, Station Newburgh, come again. I got to turn the radio up because I had two little loud ones. See if I can hear you again. Come back, please. Okay, I think I got Kilo Juliet 7, Papa Quebec Romeo. Is that correct? Okay, so let's see. Kilo Juliet 7, Papa Quebec Romeo. Now, I have you listed as Matthew. Did you say your name was Scott? Is that right? Yeah, I'm just not picking you up real well. I think if it's Matt, that makes sense. But you really have a very broken up signal there. But I think I have you checked in. If not, if you can do something about your signal and come back to us, or someone could relay, let me know here. I'm just at the limit of my hearing. Sorry. Okay, well, if I got the call sign right, that was Kilo Juliet 7, Papa Quebec Romeo Matt in Newburgh. I hope that's right. Come back later and tell me if I'm wrong, but that's what we're going to have for right now. Thank you for checking in. You're new to my log tonight. Anybody else for the emergency preparedness net?
Kilo 5, Charlie, Papa Charlie, Mike, and Happy Valley.
Whiskey 7, Victor. Hotel November, Frank in Lebanon.
Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta Richard in Salem.
Okay, it seems to be a pause in the action there. There's Richard, Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta. And you can back up a little bit on the mic there. That was plenty loud in terms of modulation there. We had Whiskey 7, Victor Hotel November, Frank in Lebanon, and Mike, Kilo 5, Charlie, Papa, Charlie, in Happy Valley. Thank you all for checking in. Let's see. Is there anybody else that would like to check in for the emergency preparedness net?
Good evening. Whiskey 3, Romeo Alpha November, Richard in Salem.
Okay, we've got Whiskey 3, Romeo Alpha November. Is that right? What was in there?
Yes, Whiskey 3, Romeo Alpha November, Richard in Salem.
Okay, Richard, I got you there. That's a new call for you, isn't it? Didn't used to be like something different, Papa Quebec Romeo or something. Is this a new call?
Previous call sign was Kilo Foxtrot 7, Echo Delta Lima. And I went to this vanity call several months ago.
Good evening, Brett. This is Kilo Juliet 7, India Bravo Hotel, Gerard in Lebanon. I had to give chase after my dog, so I couldn't get on the radio and check in over here.
Okay, that's fine. We got you there, Gerard. Kilo Juliet 7, India Bravo Hotel. Okay, let's pause here a bit. I think that's enough people right now. We've got 16 of us or so. So let's pause here and see if anybody has any announcements for the net. Any announcements of any nature? Come now, please.
Whiskey Alpha 7, Alpha Bravo Uniform.
Okay, there's Dan. Welcome. Go ahead with your announcement.
We would like to see a good turnout for Soul Scan tomorrow. It's kind of an introductory sound card mode because you can talk on the same frequency that you transmit your sound card mode. So we have a lot of fun with it. We send all kinds of pictures, but make sure it's in good taste. We do have youngsters participating. So hope to see you there, WA7AB, Wednesday night, 8 o'clock.
Okay, thank you, Dan. Does anybody else have any other announcements for the net? Any further check-ins for the emergency preparedness net? Okay, so at this time, I'll introduce Sheila Sund, MD. She is our special guest tonight. We'll answer medically related questions to COVID-19, give you an overview. She'll talk for a little bit, give you a little mini lecture of what's happening here, and then we'll take some questions after that. So with no further ado, here is Sheila Sund, MD. This is KG7GDB, your net control.
Hello, everyone. Since it's been several weeks since I last talked to you, I thought I would give you just kind of my interpretation of where numbers are. Interestingly, the United States is no longer increasing the most in the world. Actually, India and Spain are increasing, and we're decreasing. So our numbers are still astronomically high, and we're one of the worst places in the world, but as far as increase, the United States is doing better. So our percent of positive tests actually decreased from 6.9% to 6.3%. I'm not 100%. I can always trust this data based upon some of the reporting changes in the last month or two, but at least we're not having more people test positive. In general, it looks like if you divide the country into like 10 different healthcare regions, 9 of 10 of those are either kind of plateaued or improved, whereas the only place that's doing worse is actually the Midwest now, and that's the new, quote, hotspot. So we're seeing it in Minnesota, Illinois, you know, Ohio, the Dakotas, they're starting to increase. But that's the only area in the United States where things are going up right now. So overall, I would say that the United States has stabilized, but again, at daily numbers that are way too high. And as part of that, we have our deaths. We're probably averaging around 700 deaths a day. Again, reporting has gotten a little wonky on that, so I can't be certain. Interestingly enough, about 12 to 13% of the people that die in the United States every week are dying from COVID, which is pretty darn high compared to other illnesses out there. So it's still a really big problem. And for any of you that still want to compare this to flu, currently the number of people that show up at a doctor's office for a flu-like illness is probably about 1%, whereas the number that are showing up for COVID is about 2.5%. So COVID's beating flu in that regard. The way I think of the United States in general is that we are going to continue to have rolling hot spots, except they don't look so much like super hot spots like we saw back in June where cases go up radically. Instead, what seems to happen is that when cases get scarily high in a given area, you will see increased regulations about closures or mask mandates, but also you see people change their behavior before the regs are there or independent of the regs. So people wear masks more even if they're not required to, and when that happens, you see cases drop, like is happening nicely in Arizona and to a reasonable degree in Texas and Florida. But then you have areas like the Midwest where they had some cases in the beginning, but they just kind of smoldered along. And what happens with that is that people kind of get tired of this all. They get what they call quarantine fatigue. They start breaking the rules a bit more, and then the cases start creeping up. So not sudden changes like we were having when places opened up really quickly, but just, you know, people kind of not taking it as seriously. There also seems to be quite a bit of difference in the way states are handling it in terms of the expertise of their governors, the what regulations they can put on, you know, what their varying political pressures are. So I think the way we expect is that, yeah, places do better for a while than they do worse for a while, and all you can hope is that the people around you continue to take it seriously so you are not one of the places that get worse. So that brings me to Oregon, which is looking really, really pretty good. We now are considered plateaued with our R-naught, the number of cases each infection infects the next generation down the line. We're at 1.0, which basically means we are plateaued. If we drop a little bit, our cases may even start to decline, and there's some hints that may be happening, but again, because of the delay in testing and data analysis, we don't know that for sure. 2 weeks from now, I'll have a much better idea whether we might actually be even slightly declining in Oregon. Our positivity rate, how many tests that are positive, is stable at a little over 5%. That's pretty good. Most of our positive cases are still in the ages of 20 to 29, whereas most of our hospital and deaths are still in older people. Basically, what happens is young people catch it, they spread it around, and eventually it creeps into the senior citizens, and they're the ones that pay the price. We are having more cases now confirmed as having contact with somebody that was tested positive as opposed to community spread. That's also good news. In Oregon, we're still having outbreaks at nursing homes, not horrible ones, but some of them are still pretty significant, as well as outbreaks in food processing and some industrial sites. We have, as far as our economics, we're running about 10.4% unemployment, which is similar to the rest of the country, and we've added about a little bit more than a third of the jobs we lost in March and April. So that's kind of our update. Overall, again, I am glad I live in Oregon because I think our numbers are good and I think our policies are working pretty well, but most importantly, I think the people in Oregon are generally taking it fairly seriously and following the rules, and you can see that in our cases. So with that, I will open it up to questions.
Well, I don't hear anybody jumping in, so I'll ask a question, which actually a follow-up from last week. What about the saliva test thing that has come about? How accurate is it? Is it working? Are they going to use it, et cetera, et cetera? Where are we at with this?
This is ID. This is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo, and you have emergency preparedness net. Here's Dr. Sund with the answer to the question about saliva testing.
The little bit of data that we've seen on the saliva test suggests that it's pretty good, but it's fairly limited data. But it opens up a larger point regarding testing in general. As you know, all of the tests that we've been doing up until now for COVID, the great majority of them were approved under FDA emergency utilization authorization, which means that they had to provide some data, but they didn't have to provide a lot of detailed data. There have been so many tests approved at this time that we don't really know how well most of them work. The few that were tested early on by some outside universities found that they were anywhere from 10% false negatives to up to 40% false negatives. The people that have created the saliva test suggest that they're probably in the 10% rank, but that hasn't been independently confirmed by anybody else. The problem is that testing is about to get a whole lot worse. Among many other things that happened policy-wise in the last week is that an executive order was signed by the White House that said that the FDA no longer has a role in approving what they're called laboratory-developed tests. And this is COVID as well as other tests, and it's actually going to change tests. It may have the ability to change testing in the United States for all conditions significantly. So right now what happens is if you have a test that's built by a big company that then provides it to laboratories around the country, the FDA has always approved those. But the FDA has also kept an eye on if, say, just Quest wants to create their own test. They would make them submit information. Or a university wanted to create their own test, the FDA would make them submit information so they could review it and make sure it was a safe test. And so these tests that have been developed in the past for a variety of things, COVID as well as other illnesses like so cardiac disease, cancer, et cetera, the FDA has had a fairly big role in checking to make sure that they really work. And that role has now been removed by executive order. So with this new executive order that came out on August 19th, the FDA no longer has an official role of monitoring any tests that are developed by a lab. So that means a private and commercial laboratory, whether it exists or not, or whether it opens just for this purpose, can now manufacture and administer their tests, and there will be no outside review of them. As a physician, this really freaks me out, because we know under the emergency use program, many of the tests that applied to be used for COVID were not approved because they weren't validated, they weren't sensitive enough at picking it up, there were manufacturing problems, they said that they did things that they didn't, and the FDA denied them. Now the FDA is not going to have a role in any of them, so there will be a lot more COVID tests, but there will be no one to tell you whether they work or not, or whether, I mean, I guess they'll be safe, but whether they work or not. And that may be also the case with other tests that appear, including things to tell you have cardiac disease, cancer, whether you're going to respond to some medication. It's created a whole new approach to testing in this country that says basically anybody anywhere can create a test and start using it, and consumers and healthcare providers beware. So whether the saliva test works or not, maybe, but from now on out, once these other tests start showing up, I'm going to have a hard time knowing whether any COVID test is very good.
So the bottom line, nobody's going to be held accountable for whether it's good or bad, which means you got a 50-50 chance of either being good or bad. K6STX, I think that's where we stand.
Yep, I think if you get your test ordered through a reliable healthcare system and it's a test that they send out to a lab that is a multi-state lab, you're probably going to be safe. But who knows whether you're going to be safe if somebody orders that at a workplace or at a party or just your doctor says, oh, I've heard this great new test, you can get a result back really quickly. We're no longer going to know how good those tests are. And instead of increasing testing, I actually suspect that may decrease testing. It will definitely decrease my ability to know what a test means, either positive or negative.
Okay, so that was a very good question. Yeah, so are there any other questions for the doctor at this time? Okay, so I'm going to turn the mic back over to Sheila Sund, who will talk about the next topic, which has been late in the news. Here you go.
One follow-up on the testing. So I would not be surprised if over the next few months you start seeing advertisement for home testing kits for COVID and everything else like that. I would encourage you to be very cautious before you spend your money on any of those. So let's move on to the other thing that was happened significantly this week, and that was the approval of convalescent plasma. Okay, convalescent plasma is basically the liquid part of your blood, and it has no cells in it, but it has things like antibodies and other stuff like that floating around in it. And we've been trying convalescent plasma for years for a variety of diseases. Rabies, hepatitis B, polio, measles, Ebola, all kinds of things. When we don't have a good treatment for them, sooner or later somebody tries to give them plasma that has somebody else's antibodies to the disease and hope that it works. Despite playing with this for literally probably 40, 50 years, there is mostly just been like random case studies, no good research on it. And the results with other diseases have not been overwhelming whatsoever. The theory is great. Hey, yeah, give me somebody else's antibodies and I'll fight off the disease better. But so far, that's not really been very strong evidence. So, of course, early on in COVID, somebody said, well, we should try this for COVID because we also don't have any treatments for COVID. And so there were about 35,000 people in the United States that got convalescent plasma under what they considered compassionate use. So if their doctor, if they are really sick in some hospital around the country and their doctor wanted to try convalescent plasma, they could contact the Mayo Clinic and they would help them try to find it in exchange for a little bit of data, okay? It was not ever designed to be a test of how well it worked. It was really, we don't have anything better to offer, so if doctors want to try it, let them do that. So it ended up being about 35,000 people had been tried with this. It was not a study. It wasn't randomized. It wasn't blind. Everybody knew whether they were getting or not. There were no placebos. There was even a fairly significant limit of what data was collected. It was mostly pretty sick people. About half the people in it were in the ICU and over a quarter were on ventilators. It was pretty good in that it included a lot of minorities, blacks and Latinos. And what they found from those 35,000 patients is that if they got this... Oops, I forgot and timed out. So what the results were of this 35,000 patients was that if they got a transfusion of plasma within 3 days after they were diagnosed, 8.7% of them were dead at 7 days. If they got their plasma after the fourth day, then 11.9% of them were dead at 7 days. So that's not overwhelming to me. If you take sick people and you go from 8.7% of them dying to 11.9% of them dying, I mean, I'm not saying I might not try it for a patient, but that's not, these are the sickest people anyways, and it's just a slight change. It was enough to be what we call statistically significant, but there was nothing in it that said, oh, yeah, those ones with plasma, they just got rapidly better, and the ones that didn't get it, they all died. No, there was just a slight difference in the number that died. And that's really all we know about convalescent plasma at this point in time. The other thing we know is that there were no major safety concerns with 35,000 people. So unlike hydroxychloroquine, where we were concerned about safety from the very beginning because of some effects on heart rhythms, we're pretty convinced that convalescent plasma is safe. It's collected just like anything else from a blood bank, and it's tested the same as blood. So if you know you get, you know, if you get in a trauma or a surgery and you have to get some red blood cells, those, that's as safe as plasma. There's a little risk that you could have a transfusion reaction, but so far we're not seeing any problems. So as far as what we know is that, yeah, in a lot of people that were given it but not really studied, a tiny amount of the sickest ones seemed to survive when the others didn't. But despite that, we have now approved that for under emergency authorization use. And now that we've done that, that means that any doctor anywhere can use it, providing they can find the plasma somewhere. There will be no requirements for ongoing testing or reporting data, so anybody that gets it from now on, unless they choose to be in a trial, we won't know whether it works or not. We also know from those 35,000 that there was a suggestion that some plasmas were more successful. The plasmas that had higher antibodies were more successful than ones with lower antibodies, and yet we're knowing from doing antibody testing that those levels drop off. And yet there's no plan for, like, requiring a certain level of antibodies in order to give it to somebody. So from the scientific community, we feel like the approval of this convalescent plasma is not going to do much for most people, but because it's now been approved, we think it's going to be used a lot without any proof that it really helps. Hopefully it won't hurt, but that's about it. So any questions about this? Oh, and I should mention, right now, convalescent plasma, there's no money in it. You have to find somebody that has been sick and is willing to give their plasma. But there are a lot of pharmacologic companies that are trying to grow COVID antibodies on their own in the lab. And if once plasma is approved, because antibodies are supposed to be helpful, we're anticipating that a lot of these companies are going to start coming up with their own treatments of lab-grown antibodies. And so it may be that there is money to be made in it somewhere. Time will tell. Any questions on plasma?
K6STS.
Okay, Dan, go ahead with the question.
What if this plasma was given to a healthy person and they build up some kind of antibodies in their blood before they got sick? Is there any chance that might even help, or does anybody even know?
We don't know. Nobody's tested that. There's not a lot of plasma. In fact, they've been trying to get people to donate it. That would have been an interesting study to do. But so far, we've only given it to people that were mostly in the hospital and pretty sick. Because it's like a transfusion. You pretty much have to at least be an outpatient in a hospital in order to get it. I would anticipate that if it becomes more available, we'll see people starting to give it for a whole variety of things, including prevention. But the problem, again, is once you allow anybody to use it for anything, our ability to know whether it works or not pretty much disappears. So, yeah, I would anticipate we're all going to be able to try that either in the form of the plasma or when the pharm companies start making antibodies for us to take. But I don't know that it's going to work, and I don't know that we'll be able to tell one way or the other. So that's not normally the way we do medicine. We don't normally approve things until we're pretty sure that they work. But in this case, we've decided to approve it, and I guess you and your insurance company are going to have to decide whether you want to pay for something that we don't know about.
Okay, good question. Any other questions about the whole convalescent plasma report here? That was a big item in the news, a lot of controversy, a lot of arguments back and forth on it, and I think our group is hopefully, yeah, again, there's no such thing as dumb questions, so if you need something explained that we can go over it. If you don't, we can, you know, if you don't get what, you know, obviously the convalescent plasma comes from people who have recovered from a COVID infection, okay? Don't know at what time during their recovery, but that's what. They're convalescing. They're recovering from COVID. That's where that term comes from. Any other questions about that?
One other thing that came up here this last week or so was reinfection. Somebody who had it, who then they thought was recovered, and then apparently got it all over again. Maybe we address that, or maybe I'm jumping ahead of the gun here, K6SDX.
Yep, KG7GB. That is up on the docket. Let's just pause here and say this is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo. We have the Emergency Preparedness Net with Sheila Sun, MD, who's answering your questions about COVID. Does anybody else want to check in at this time, or can we get it? You know, Dan has great questions, but, you know, other people can ask check-ins, questions. Come now, please. Okay, so I'm going to have her address the question about the person who got COVID after recovering. Dr. Sund, here you go.
So let's talk about just this one person because it is the only proven one so far. And this was a guy in Hong Kong that clearly had COVID back in, I don't know, March or something like that. He was tested positive. They knew, they even checked which virus it was. And it was the original strain of virus that came from China. He got better completely. He went and visited Europe, and then he came back home and tested positive again. He tested negative for a couple months, He doesn't have symptoms now, but they do a lot of testing in Hong Kong, particularly if you've traveled. And so he tested positive, and they followed it up, and they found that, yes, he really does have it. But interestingly enough, now he has the European strain of it. So before he had the Chinese strain, and now he has the European strain. What does this mean? Does it mean that, you can get one and you're protected against one and not the other? No. We don't think that the difference in being infected with one or the other is, one's not worse than the other, really. It's more a matter that it proves that you can be reinfected. And what I have noticed in the public health community over the last 2 months is that they don't want reinfection to be possible. And it's funny because in the very beginning, when this was all COVID was coming out in January, February, and March, all of the scientists out there were saying, hey, it looks like there's probably a lot of asymptomatic cases. And all the public health experts kept saying, no, they have mild symptoms. They didn't have symptoms yet. We don't have to worry about asymptomatic people having it. And as you all know now that, yes, that's one of the major reasons it's spreading is because, 9 out of 10 people with it are asymptomatic and yet quite infectious. So that was the first thing where there was a kind of a desire of the public health community internationally not to want something to be, even though there were starting to be hints. The second one was, could it be, was it aerosol? Could you catch it from breathing it in? And again, the pieces, little pieces were coming out, and scientists all around the world were saying, hey, look, this thing is probably aerosolized. And all the big public health entities around the world said, no, it can't possibly be. It's just droplets. People need to wash their hands better, et cetera, et cetera. And as you know, we now know it's aerosolized, and the thing that's made a difference is masks. So currently, the thing that everybody in public health seems to be denying is the possibility that people can be reinfected. And the honest-to-God truth is we don't know, okay? There have been a number of cases showing up in case reports and things where individual doctors or clinics have reported somebody that they think has been reinfected, and the public health entities have said, no, they just never got better from it in the first place, or it's just virus particles, it's not really infection, or something like that. So this one Hong Kong case is important because it is the first time we've been able to prove that, yes, somebody does get reinfected, and we proved it because there's two different strains. There's probably a number of people getting reinfected. We just don't know how many. Hopefully it's rare, but there's increasing bits of evidence out there that, yes, reinfection is a possibility. So why is this such a big deal? Because if reinfection is a possibility, then vaccines aren't going to work very well. And the entire world has kind of hung their response to COVID on the fact that we're going to come up with a vaccine, and when you get a vaccine, it's going to work so well that everybody will go back to doing normal life, and the economy will get better and everything. So, I mean, we basically, nobody is really planning what to do if it doesn't. Vaccines don't work. We're just assuming that when we have a vaccine, it will work because we want it to work. And the honest to God truth is we don't know. I have good reason to hope it's going to work, but we don't know. We know that we've never been able to come up with a good vaccine for colds because people don't get that great of a response to them. We know that with flu, you need a vaccine every year, and we've not been very good at doing that. Only about 45% of the adults get a flu shot in any given year. And so there's plenty of reason to worry that COVID may be similar, but nobody wants to admit that maybe we can get reinfected, or even if we are immune, it won't last that long. And so right now, the honest-to-gosh truth is we don't know. We all hope we will have immunity for a few years, either after getting the illness or getting the vaccine, but we don't know.
Okay, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. So kind of an important finding there with that, even one person, you know. So sometimes the proof, in this case, the fact that there were two different strains and they have different genetic sequences showed that it wasn't that he had the same strain and it never went away. You know, so a lot of questions were answered like that. So, but that means that we need to look a little more carefully at what's happening and take that into consideration in our planning. Are there any questions about the subject of reinfection or on that line?
K7NUI.
There's Bill. Go ahead.
Are there more than two strains? And briefly, what's the difference between the two strains?
The strains are just a mutation that makes the virus look a little bit different. So kind of imagine identical twins, but if you really, really, really look close at identical twins, you can see something that's a little bit different about them. You know, one has a slightly different shaped nose or a slightly different shade of hair color. That's kind of the equivalent of the two strains we're currently dealing with. And this is normal for viruses. Viruses mutate all the time. I mean, like, literally the virus you're infected with will have had some mutations by the time you eventually recover from it. But most of them don't stick. If they do stick enough that new mutated virus starts reproducing successfully on its own, then it becomes another strain. However, most of the time strains aren't really different in terms of what they do, like how sick they make you or whether they're infectious or not. Mostly they're just a way of kind of tracking a virus. So we know that in the beginning all the virus looked a certain way and that came from China. And then sometime after it moved to Europe, a slight variation, the twin with slightly blonder hair, shall we say, was just a little more effective at infecting people. And so gradually in Europe, you know, that there were more viruses that looked like that than looked like China. But in the beginning, you have to realize there might have been 10 from China, and those 10 may have died out, but the European variation stayed. So, in general, we're used to seeing strains. Like in Ebola, I don't know, I think we've identified 10 different strains of Ebola. Most of them act exactly the same. A few of them have a little higher fatality rate. So far, the only difference we've told between the two major strains of COVID is that maybe the European one is slightly more infectious, but that theory has not been proved. The rest of what it does is pretty identical, how it gets in your body, all that comes to the same. So most of the time when you hear about a new strain, it's just a slightly different twin or maybe eventually a triplet or a quadruplet, but it still pretty much looks identical unless you're in the know. And the way unlike a twin where you can look at them and say their hair is different, the way we know they're different from a lab is that if we look at their DNA, there's a little bit different DNA in one strain than the other, so we can identify them. We can say, oh, this is this strain and this is this strain. In the Hong Kong guy that's been reinfected, it allowed us to say, yep, the first time it was the one that came from China and the second time was the one that came from Europe, two different strains, he got reinfected. Whereas everybody else, they, you know, like if you check somebody in New York City that got it in March and now said they had it again, it would look the same strain, and so we wouldn't be able to prove it, and a lot of people would say, no, they've always been sick all along. So that's really what the strains are. They're mostly a way for scientists to identify and track viruses.
Okay. Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. We have the emergency preparedness set. Good questions. Again, are there any other questions about that, the issue of the reinfection and what happened there?
Yep. One more question, K6STX.
Okay. Go ahead, Dan.
This fella that got sick in Hong Kong, was he just as sick or worse or less worse the second time around? Or was it just a mild case? Or was he just as bad off the first time as the second time? Or vice versa?
The Hong Kong guy had no symptoms the second time around. But we don't know whether that's because he maybe had partial immunity and didn't get as sick, or whether he was just going to, this was just the 9 out of 10 times that you don't have symptoms whatsoever. So the first time he had symptoms, but he wasn't horribly sick. The second time, no symptoms. What that says about his immune status, we have no idea. Again, all we know is that one person has absolutely proven that you can get reinfected with some type of COVID. Now, he may be, you know, maybe there is 0.00000001% of people in the world that can get reinfected, in which case vaccines will work and everything will be great. It's just that we've never been able to prove that anybody has before, and now we know that at least a tiny number of people are going to be able to be reinfected. And only time is going to tell us whether that is 0.0001 or 1% or 10% or more. It's just we're only 3 to 4 months into this thing before most people had it. There's just no way to know what our immunity is going to be yet.
Okay, so another good question there about that subject. Let's see. I know that, just to mention here, this Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo has emergency preparedness net, and Richard Whiskey Zero Echo Delta Foxtrot does try to record these sessions for us, and we'll have those later on the WA7ABU groups.io page under the files there. So if you're not a member of that, make sure you're and you'd like to go back and look at that stuff. There's a link at the top of the WA7ABU.com page, and you should get the recording from last week and prior sessions that we've had on this topic. And Richard, although he's not here tonight, he'd have a question about the influenza season this year and how that's supposed to work out. Will that be different for us? And I'm going to just let Dr. Sun address that question so he has a recording the answer.
There's a lot of worry about influenza season. I don't think anybody has an answer yet. There are some reasons to think it will be a good flu season if we continue to do all the preventions against COVID. They should also work pretty good against flu. I mean, we normally get flu, you know, if somebody gets it in the office and it goes around the office, or your kid brings it home from school and then the whole family gets sick. If you're not going to school and you're not working in the office, you would suspect a whole lot less flu. So personally, I am guessing a lower flu season than normal because I think everything that works for COVID will also help decrease flu. I am more worried about COVID and flu as the nice weather goes away. It's much easier to socially distance and go to a restaurant outside and, you know, and enjoy visiting people on your back deck at 6 feet away than it will be when it turns cold. And so I am concerned that both flu and COVID will go up when the weather is no longer so nice, and that makes people stop doing all the good social distancing that they're doing. And I think most of the scientists are more worried about that than flu per se. I will point out, though, that in the beginning when we first looked at COVID, the CDC actually would not let anybody do COVID testing on people that had a positive flu test because they didn't think there was any way you could possibly have one. And we actually missed a whole lot of COVID cases in the beginning. What we eventually found is that, yes, one can get both COVID and flu at the very same time. And guess what? When you get them both, you're far more likely to end up in the hospital and sick. And so if we do start getting more flu and more COVID as the weather gets worse and we spend more time indoors, it may be a worse flu season in terms of severity of illness. We might go up in hospitalizations and deaths from COVID, flu, or both together. I still am hoping that there will be less overall cases of flu as long as we continue to stick with the social distancing.
Okay, so hopefully that answered Richard's question. Are there any other questions following up about flus or flu vaccines or how the two interact? Come now, please.
FWP?
Yeah, Jennifer, go ahead, please.
I certainly appreciate Sheila's comments there. I guess I just have a follow-up question regarding flu vaccine. For those of us who have, reason to have a flu vaccine in a normal year and are very aware of, the risk of going into medical facilities and that sort of thing, even with social distancing and pretty well quarantined here in our household, for example, are we still better off to go in and get the flu vaccine and, risk that exposure in the clinic, or is being home going to be enough protection?
I'm getting a flu vaccine as soon as they're available, and I'm usually fairly lazy about getting in and getting it, but I'll get mine in October. And partly it's because, again, this really brings home illness in general, having watched COVID this year. And I do know if you have flu and COVID together, you're going to get a lot sicker. So a flu vaccine is worth it. It could be in a clinic. It could be at your local pharmacy. I would encourage you to kind of look at what your options are so that you can go to the safest setting. Like I often get my shots at the local Walgreens, but I call them and I see how busy they are, and I, bug them until they can tell me a time of day where they think it's going to be relatively low, and that's when I show up. And so far I've been pretty successful with not having very many people inside the Walgreens when I go. So actually I probably would feel a little safer in there than I would at my doctor's office where there's more likely to be sick people. But if you have a small doctor's office, that might be better, and I do think hospitals and doctor's offices in general are doing a pretty good job at keeping things clean and masking and stuff. So bottom line, get a flu shot, but get it at whatever you can find the safest setting to be. Get it in October. Let's keep the flu season low because it will make COVID less bad.
WA7ABU.
Dan, go ahead with your question.
Just wanted to mention, I was also concerned about going in when we get a chance to get that shot. Should I go into Rite Aid or what's the deal? And I had a long conversation with a health professional with Kaiser Permanente, and she recommended that I go into Kaiser for the shot because it's much cleaner in there than it would be in Rite Aid, where I normally get my flu shot. Going into Kaiser for another purpose, I was very shocked at the way there's hardly anybody in the building. They have very tall ceilings. It's a really large building with nobody in it. There's two people at a checkpoint going in the building, checking to make sure you have a valid reason to go in. And then there's actually a guard standing at the door, making sure that nobody goes in and contaminates the building. They check you going in, and I was pretty impressed with the cleanliness of the building. I saw several workers only going around cleaning everything. Pretty amazing cleaning, WA7ABU.
Well, I definitely agree that to get your flu shot, you're going to have to look at your individual options. Once upon a time, I had Kaiser briefly, and even back pre-COVID, they at that point in time, their flu clinic was run pretty well. There weren't a lot of crowds. There wasn't a lot of wait. And I agree that most of the Kaiser facilities I've been in are big with lots of air. But not everybody has Kaiser, so you're really going to have to look at what your clinic is like. How fast can you get in and out? Do you get an exact appointment versus how bad is your local store? Again, I've been into a Walgreens twice, once because I had to pick up some bandage supplies, and I was amazed. There's, like, nobody in there, and so if I was really prepared and could get in and out in 5 to 10 minutes, and I wore an N95, I might be okay. But you're each going to have to decide that on your own. And I wanted to push out one other reason for getting a flu shot, and this is not COVID-specific, it's just flu shot in general, is, you know, again, we only managed to get about 45% of adults vaccinated, and that's because people go, well, it doesn't work that well, I still got the flu anyways, you know, and it's true. We have to guess every year what strains are going to be out there. It's that strain thing again, identical twins, triplets, whatever, a flu. And sometimes the guess is good and it works better, and sometimes the guess is bad and it doesn't work as well. But one thing we noticed back in H1N1 is that by having people that got flu shots all the time, they actually build up a general immunity to all flu viruses. And so the more flu shots you have over your life, the less likely you are to get really serious if you do get flu. And so even though you could argue, well, I'm quarantined, I'm not going to get it this year, it's actually going to decrease your chronic immunity to flu. And so for that reason, I actually encourage everybody to get a flu shot every year, even if you're not going to have any exposure or you don't believe in it. I do believe a flu shot is extremely safe, and it gives you kind of a chronic immunity to flu, even though you may still get it in any year. Chances are you'd get sicker more often if you didn't get flu shots regularly.
Okay, we've only got about 2 minutes left here. That was another good question about the flu shots. Let's see. One last thing that I think we need to cover tonight just a little bit has to do with the rapid approval of the COVID vaccines and what that implies for us here. So I wanted to finish off that discussion with that. And here's Dr. Sund.
And I've talked about the COVID vaccines before, and I have told you guys that I probably will not be an early adopter of running out and getting one myself, but that I was going to wait to see what the data showed. And it's not because I'm an anti-vaxxer. I just pushed for flu shots, so you know I believe in vaccines. But I have been worried all along that the COVID vaccine process, even if done right, that it's going to take longer than they're anticipating to really know how effective it is and how safe it is. This is a little going to veer into politics, but I think it's important to realize I am more worried about the vaccine now than I was a week ago, and that's because of the two things that have happened where the Trump administration has chosen to bypass scientific recommendations, both in terms of approving convalescent plasma, even though every scientist out there says there's not enough data to approve it. And the other one was to remove FDA oversight over lab testing. And both of those things from a medical scientific perspective are very concerning, because those are the things that we use to know whether any treatment or any vaccine works and whether it's safe. And so we now have several instances in this administration of going against the science. And because the administration will have a lot to do with approving vaccines, I'm even more nervous that we will have adequate data about vaccines before they are approved. Both China and Russia are now choosing to vaccinate their citizens before phase 3 trials have completed, so before they've shown either effectiveness fully or before they've shown safety. And I would never have thought we would be at risk of that in this country, but I'm a little bit nervous. So I just want people to realize that a safe and effective vaccine is not going to be available in September, probably not in November, maybe by January and almost definitely by next spring. So vaccines that come out faster than that timeline, I'll wait to see what the data shows, if the data is available, but I'm a little nervous about this.
Okay, any final questions or comments about that? I guess the thing is, all the things that we've talked about, you know, that this new bits of evidence, so they think about how long COVID has been around for us. So we first started thinking about it and doing stuff about it in January or February in this country. And at this point in time, you know, this, now we finally showed, yes, there's somebody gets that can get reinfected, okay? So, you know, we have to wait and see what happens when they do these vaccine trials and see, are they effective? Are they safe? And that, again, it's probably going to take at least as long to see if those things are correct. So it does take time, unfortunately, to get results, and that's what we're facing. Okay, it is 8:02 p.m. Are there any final questions or comments on this that we can, again, address them next week? If you have questions that you didn't get to answer tonight, you can address them to my call sign, Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo at ARRL.net, and I'll forward them to Dr. Sunt. And anyway, final comments or questions? Come now, please. Okay, very good. Good session tonight. Thank you, everyone. Time is now 8:03 p.m. This concludes the 529 Emergency Preparedness Net. Again, there will be a recording available tonight's discussion, available on the groups.io page for WA7ABU. This net meets each Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on 145.29 MHz. Our thanks go out to Dan, WA7ABU, for the use of the repeater. Thank you to our guest, Sheila Sund, MD. Thanks to all who participated today and those who stood by to give us a clear channel. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, now closing the net at 8:04 p.m. We now return the repeater to normal, undirected amateur operations. KG7 GDB, I'm clear.